a real clear tutorial on why we need constitutional education. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is my Vice Chairman, my co-host, my good friend, my fellow analyst, and constitutional teacher. And boy, we could have used a lot of that on Wednesday afternoon, Chuck Michaels.
Well, Barry, it's good to be here. And, you know, our experience yesterday reminds me of the old saying that's been attributed to Otto von Bismarck, and that is that anyone who loves the law or sausages should never watch either one being made.
That is absolutely correct. You see, ladies and gentlemen, on Wednesday late afternoon, Chuck and I had the distinct privilege to go down to the Ohio State House, and Chuck gave testimony in support of Senate Bill 165, which is the Founding of America Documents Bill. We've talked about this proposal before on this program. It's a bill that would require our State Department of Education and our schools, public schools in Ohio, to actually teach our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, which we found out on Wednesday, Chuck, must be an entirely separate document. It's very short. Along with the Ohio Constitution.
According to certain methods of reading the Constitution, some people apparently think our side believes that the Constitution consists of certain handpicked amendments and nothing else counts.
We're going to unpack that today, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to give you a brief glimpse inside the process of making legislative sausage. Chuck testified, and you can find copies of that testimony. We'll be posting them up to the Principal Policy site at principalpolicy.com if you want to read a little bit more about it. But what happened on Wednesday afternoon in the House Education Committee was that the bill, Senate Bill 165, sponsored by Senator Larry Obhoff of the Medina area, and also sponsored in the House by Representative John Adams in Shelby County, this bill had been in hearings and was up for its hearing, marked for any amendments and a possible vote. Well, you would think that something as simple as saying, hey, you know, we're Americans, we should teach our history and teach the founding documents, that'd be a no-brainer. Chuck, it should have taken, what, about 8-10 minutes tops, had three people testifying in support of the bill, and a couple of very brief amendments. Should have taken, what, 8-10 minutes tops for this hearing?
Oh, tops. This should have been hear testimony, tack on the amendments, and let's go to the races. And
let's send it out to the floor of the House. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michaels and I were sitting in the committee room from the time the gavel dropped to the time the last vote was taken on this bill, and only on this bill, for an hour and 37 minutes. It took an hour and 37 minutes to get something that's basically common sense through a committee. Now, in that time period, we saw an awful lot about the legislative process. We had a caucus where they had to stop everything and the members go to their separate corners, so to speak, in different rooms, with the Democrat caucus going into one room and the Republican caucus going into another room to discuss the amendments that had been presented to the committee. Usually, ladies and gentlemen, this doesn't happen. Every once in a while, on something that's extremely contentious, or on amendments that are extremely technical in nature and wide-ranging and expansive, you might get the two parties decide, well, we need to go and chat over this to see where we are as a caucus. Well, we had that happen. It was about 15 minutes, wasn't it, Chuck? They were out and debating amongst themselves, but not with each other at that point.
It was about 15 or 17 minutes, something like that.
Too many things were going on with this bill. What happened was, as this bill was coming forward, a number of hearings had been given. People had testified on all sides of the bill, and they were getting ready to mark it up. Now, we had mentioned earlier, we were concerned about a potential amendment that was going to possibly be offered on it that would have been problematic. But that amendment never appeared. It never made it. And so basically, what we have is a couple of amendments. And the one was brought by the majority party at the request of House sponsor John Adams, that would clarify that the teaching should start in the fourth grade, because the Senate version didn't start it until high school. So they wanted to back it up so we could start teaching our founding documents earlier. And also a provision that basically said, yes, you need to test on it in the state testing, and you have to devote a certain amount of time on the test to these documents, because we're serious about making sure our students learn our American history and the source of our liberties and the source of our government. So that amendment honestly shouldn't have been any problem, but when that amendment was brought up for discussion, Chuck, you would have thought the bottom had fallen out of the world.
I'm telling you, it was as if we had proposed to teach classes in how to bully people. They treated us as if what we were trying to do was create some kind of a strange societal anomaly wherein people are actually learning what the founding documents meant when they wrote them. The gist of the questioning was that they couldn't believe that anyone would want to teach the original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Ohio Constitution, possibly the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers. And in fact, we were given lengthy lectures from one caucus on these issues. One representative who had been a history teacher basically said he just couldn't believe that we would actually tell him that he had to teach these documents when he was in school. Under what circumstances was the state legislature setting curricula for teachers to teach? And the fact is that state legislature, of course, sets curricula all the time. Yeah, we have a core curriculum that includes things like mathematics and sciences. Yeah, the state legislature sets core curricula all the time.
And the state legislature also does specify how things are to be taught and what things are supposed to be taught in it. As a matter of fact, back when I worked in the legislature, we did a little thing called the abstinence law, where we said that in the health curricula, you must teach. And we specified what was to be taught in relation of abstaining from sexual activity until marriage, and taught all the specifics on, you know, the dangers of having children out of wedlock and the financial costs and the legal ramifications. Those were all specified in that law, which passed. And if I remember correctly, that member, who's Ron Gerberry from the Youngstown area, he's a Democrat. He was the former chairman of the Education Committee a number of years ago when the Democrats were in the majority. He was on the committee when that resolution passed, and if I remember correctly, he voted against it then, too. But he was stating that he was opposed to this bill because we can't mandate what we teach in the schools. I leaned over to Chuck in the committee hearing room, and I said, we are not supposed to mandate curriculum, but the point is that we do it all the time. I leaned over to Chuck and during that soliloquy from that member and said, I guess we're supposed to let the federal government mandate it for us. You see, when the Democrats were in control and Ted Strickland was pushing his evidence-based education model, they were great with having the feds come in and hand them off curricula models to be taught. That didn't seem to bother them then, but it certainly bothered them with teaching our Constitution now. And folks, we heard everything. We heard from one member that, you know, basically we were trying to go back to the days of slavery, and that we were trying to insinuate by teaching the document in its original context, we, and I say, and that meant the majority party and those who were supporting the bill, were actually trying to restart this discussion as to whether or not blacks are whole persons or not. And Chuck, we both know that member, Clayton Luckey, who is African-American from the Dayton area, obviously doesn't even know his history because he understands. They weren't trying to treat blacks as three-fifths of a person. They were just basically talking about whether or not to count those who were held in slavery as part of the full population for representation purposes.
A quick history lesson, and we were basically lectured on history that we actually knew very well on the Constitution. The phraseology was certain people as three-fifths of a person. Three-fifths of a man.
Yes.
The actual language says other persons shall be counted as three-fifths of a person. And in the section that's dealing with counting heads for representation, another quick history lesson here that I'm willing to bet that Representative Luckey doesn't know. The fact is that at the Constitutional Convention where this three-fifths compromise was made, the North argued that slaves should be counted as zero. In other words, the slaves should not be allowed to count at all for representation purposes. The South was arguing that blacks, of course, were persons. This is the argument. Southerners said, despite the fact that they're in slavery, they are persons, and they should be counted for purposes of representation. What that would have meant was, because some Southern states had more than 50% of their population as black slaves, they would have had more than 50% of their population who was completely disenfranchised, but still counted as persons for the purpose of representation. Well, what that would have meant was that the North would have been overwhelmed by Southern representation. That really shouldn't be a big deal if we're all one big happy country, right? But the fact is that there was regionalism as early as 1787 while they were putting this together. Honestly, the states didn't like each other very much, and there was a big divide between North and South even then. And it really had nothing to do with slavery. It had to do with economics, had to do with trade issues, had to do with any number of things. If we had been asked that question, we were loaded for bear on it. Nobody chose to ask that question of us. There was another person from the State Board of Education who got beat up pretty badly, but it wasn't us. But Barry, one thing I want to mention is,
yes,
what we witnessed last night is something that I really wish it had been recorded, because what you can see is the great philosophical divide between two factions in this country. And we were given a big long lecture about the two ways of reading the Constitution, the strict constructionist method and the living document method. And I really had wished we had been questioned on that, because the reply to the living document advocates is, okay, you're fine with the living document now because it's going your way. Let's say in another era, though, that someone else decides to basically amend the Constitution by reinterpreting it, doing what Thomas Jefferson called making a blank paper by construction. In other words, interpreting all the meaning out of the words. What if it goes against them? What if it goes against the liberal side and suddenly it goes toward some kind of strange reactionary ultra-conservatism? Will they be sanguine about the living document method of reading the Constitution at that point? Somehow, I don't think so, Barry. Somehow, I think we're going to find that suddenly a whole lot of living document advocates suddenly become strict constructionists. And in fact, I know this because I've seen it. Every once in a while, people on the right will come up with some novel interpretation of some section of the Constitution. And you and I have talked about this. And suddenly the other side goes from living document to very strict constructionist. That's not what the words say. Well, no kidding. But you can't have your cake and eat it too. It's one or the other, folks.
That's absolutely correct. Now, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, this was amazing because honestly, the most absurd part of the entire debate, this whole hour and 37 minutes that we had to set through this painful exercise, was that there was another amendment offered by the minority party, Dan Ramos, who's a Democratic representative. It was four little words. The four little words was, "and all subsequent amendments." Now, the reason why that this was ludicrous was because the Democrat caucus had got it into their head somehow, some way, and it couldn't be taken out of there by logic, reason, or explanation, no matter how hard you tried, that when you referenced the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, you were going to stop at the 10th Amendment and not talk about any other amendment. 11 through 27 would not exist in this new lesson plan that they were contemplating. And so they wanted to make sure that we weren't going to try to avoid the issue and talk about how the 14th Amendment applied all of these things to the states and women's suffrage. You know, and honestly, Chuck, I think we need to talk about this stuff. We also need to talk about how the 27th Amendment was actually the original Second Amendment in the first iteration of the Bill of Rights. We also need to talk about the fact that, and Chuck and I said this on the way out, and talked to one of the members, and we offered to present an Institute on the Constitution course for our elected officials, because it was obvious many of them in both parties had no idea what the Constitution said or how to defend those charges, because, ladies and gentlemen, Article 5 of the United States Constitution makes it very clear and explicit language that any amendment that's passed under the Constitution by the procedures found in Article 5 become part of the Constitution. Therefore, when you mandate to teach the Constitution, you are by direct implication mandating the teaching of all 27 amendments to that document.
It's not even implicit. It's explicit by way of the fifth article. There's some real absurdities, and I'd love to talk about this more, but unfortunately, we are out of time.
Well, before we leave, though, we just have to let people know the bill did pass the House Education Committee by a vote of 12-8, strictly on party lines. It is scheduled to be on the floor of the Ohio House sometime next week, either Tuesday or Wednesday. Call your state representative, Jerry Stubbleton, who was the Education Committee chairman, who I think did a pretty good job of trying to keep the train running the right direction.
You're right.
But being gracious to people who obviously were not trying to be gracious at all to him or to anybody else. Call those members and ask them to support Senate Bill 165, the Founding of America Documents Bill. We need to make sure our young people are learning their form of government and the history behind it in its original content. We ask that you would do that. Call your House members. You can go to our website to find the contact information. And again, that's going to be next week that bill is going to be up. And once it passes the House, it'll be concurred upon in the Senate because the Senate sponsor agreed with all the changes. And it will be signed into law by Governor Kasich. And then the State Department and the State Board of Education will start ensuring that our children will actually learn our history.
Join us tomorrow at noon for our 1 hour Principles and Policies program here on WLRY.